So, Berto, this is chapter 2 in our deep dive on the psychology of Jodi Arias.
Wow.
And I thought we would start off this chapter by talking about why are cases like these cases, mm-hmm. like the Jodi Arias case and the trial, why are they so fascinating to us as a culture? Why are they highlighted in the media? And the first thing I want to go into is even supporting that hypothesis that it is unusual that it is highlighted. You know, there are things about this, you know, many people say, well, you know, it's a murder, it's fascinating. But let me give you some stats as to, mm-hmm. to differentiate as to why would this kind of case. So if we look at statistics, these are 2020 stats, by the way, percentage of murders that are committed by men, people yeah. identify as men, what percentage in the United States of murders are committed by men?
70%.
87.
87.
Wow. Now, you know, it's still 13% either people identify as
that's
women
very high.
or other. But, you know, a lot of murders, vast majority committed by percentage of intimate partner murders committed by men.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. So I'll go 80%.
Very good. 78%.
Okay.
So there's a higher rate of
overall
of yeah. women killing men. But in their overall, it's still a vast majority yeah. of men who, you know, who are the committers of murder of a partner. Percentage of murder victims who were black. So victims.
Victims who were black.
Who were black.
Ooh. From overall murders? From
well,
overall.
So let's start off with what is the percentage of Americans who identify as black?
Oh, I see. 20%?
25? 12%.
12%. Okay.
So what percentage? So if everything was equal, it'd be 12% of right. murder victims were black. But what do you right. think the real percentage is? Well,
percent of murder victims that are black is like 50%.
Good. 56. So much more likely.
Yeah.
percentage of murder victims who are black, 56%.
56%.
Even though black people amount to 12% of yeah. the American population. Now, we could, of course, talk about all the historical and systemic racism yep. that's involved in that, and police brutality, and poverty, and oppression, and you know all that stuff, of course. But those are the facts, that the vast majority of murders are committed by men, and the vast majority of victims of murder
right.
are probably black men, or, yeah. or at least black people.
Yeah.
And it seems, though, that white women are way overrepresented in the media when it comes to these kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Not only if they're the perpetrator, but also if they're the victim.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of talk more recently in the media, but in my field, in my discipline, we've been yammering about this for decades, that it, you know, if a black woman is raped and killed across town, the media just doesn't even mention it. But
right.
if a white woman is abducted, then it's a, you know,
international news.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, yeah. You know, that woman who, you know, tragically, Gabby Petito
yeah.
a couple years ago.
Like, all of these are tragedies.
Yeah.
All of them.
yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
And of course, they deserve to be told and yeah. you know, and attempted to find the perpetrator or find her because she was missing for a while. But at the same time, there's, you know, so many other people in more likelihood of other sorts of people that from other groups that are yeah. not being reported on. All right. There are also a lot of movie depictions that are way overrepresentative of women perpetrators of intimate partner murder or violence or control, this kind of thing.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, can you think of any movies off the top of your head?
Gone Girl. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, it's another Fatal Attraction.
Fatal Attraction, yeah.
Play Misty for Me. Single White Female.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Ooh, there's a lot. Isn't that with Rebecca De Mornay?
Yep. Yeah. The Crush with Alicia
right,
Silverstone.
Right.
All About Steve, 2009 with Bradley Cooper, Sandra Bullock.
I don't think I saw that.
The Boy Next Door, 2015, Jennifer Lopez, Ryan Guzman, and many others.
Yeah.
You know, we have a fascinating. Now, you say, well, you know, there's a lot of movies about men who are obsessed with women or who
right.
who stalk women. Well, I could only think of a few. For example, Phantom of the Opera, which was made into a movie. Fear with Marky Mark and
yeah.
Reese Witherspoon. It's kind of a classic.
But you example. Could also say that any of the like Psycho and American Psycho, and like any, there's a lot of guy psycho movies where, yeah, where the guy is the bad guy. Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees.
Yeah, you know. But maybe not specifically focusing on one individual, like right, a like a, you
know, a oh yeah, yeah. It's more like, yeah, that's true. Those
they're
are
just generally films. Psycho, right? Yeah. But with Phantom of the Opera and Fear,
yeah,
and with The Crush and Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Fatal Attraction, this is someone that is not just a psychopathic, sadistic killer. It's someone who is obsessed and stalking and maybe even trying to kill this right, one romantic interest. You, the TV show on Netflix. But, and I'm sure there are a few other examples, but in my anecdotal analysis, we as a society are much more likely to be interested and tell stories when women are abusing their men, their intimate partners that are men, and trying to kill them. You know, so if you yeah, just, if aliens watched our movies, they would think that women are the perpetrators of that crime.
And I think probably because in general, we want movies and fiction that is not day-to-day stuff.
Okay, so that's one of the theories. Yeah. So let's list them out.
Like, that's why we have Jaws, you know?
Okay, so that's one of the theories, that yeah, it's novel, right? Yeah. It's unusual. This yeah, case where you have a woman, the argument, everyone understands that most of the time when an intimate partner is stalking and killing their former partner, yeah, it's a man killing a wife. But, you know, that's mundane. It's a given. But yeah, when a woman does it, that's newsworthy. Okay, so we could throw that out there. It's hard to know exactly what motivates the public, but we could throw that. What are some other hypotheses?
Well, there's the fact that it's a woman, but also the kind of woman, because, like, this appears to be I hate to say it, but it's someone that you would not expect to do it from our preconceived notions of society, because they probably, you would imagine they live in a better part of town, they are lighter skinned, they seem to, whether they do or not, they seem to have more means at their disposal, blah, blah, blah. And so we're like, whoa, what? We thought all criminals looked like this, and we're, you know. So there's the sex, also the race, also the socioeconomic status, also the probably the demeanor in this case, you know, the, it's not like, yeah, and I'll kill them all and I'll do it again. I'm a psycho, right? It's like, I don't know, officer, you know?
Okay.
So a lot of those factors.
That's another idea.
There's also a timing issue, which is, I think you said that there were two that year. There's probably a lot every year, but I think maybe the media picked up on both because they were close to each other.
Oh, you so know? One became a media sensation, and then the other one was like,
the media,
hey, this is the new one. This is yeah, a new Casey Anthony.
Yeah.
Okay, I can see that.
There's also the level, the egregiousness of the situation. Because, again, there's probably a lot of cases. In fact, there are a lot of cases where a woman did kill her partner. Maybe even stalked and killed the partner. But then when you start stacking all the additional circumstances, like the cross-state lines, the over-the-top nature of the killing itself, the over-the-top nature of the line, like all those kinds of things make it also stand out. If the story was like, it was a woman, she killed her husband, and then you see the interview, it's like, yeah, I did it, it was horrible. Yeah, like, okay, well, fine. But it's not. It's, there's layers and layers and layers, and every single aspect of it is over the top. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, given that it could arguably be said that this is the first live streamed on the internet. You know, yeah, if you say Casey Anthony was the first social media based crime,
yeah,
meaning that all the social media pictures that were mined as a way of trying to not only convict her and demonstrate that she was guilty, but also to throw at the press so that everyone could talk. You know, you could say that O.J. Simpson was the first live television, you know, trial of the century. And then the Jodi Arias trial was the very first YouTubed,
right,
live streamed.
I mean, it's like the O.J. example is like, how often do you have a world famous star?
Yeah.
In a chase on live TV,
yeah,
after brutally, you know, allegedly murdering,
yeah, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, if it happened 10 years earlier, we would have read in the newspaper the next day,
yeah,
that O.J. Simpson was on the road, and, you know, they'd summarize, yeah, it, but you wouldn't really have felt it the way that you felt it,
right,
when we were watching that live. And given the fact that there are so many details to pour over and talk about online and, you know, keep you watching.
That said, Lizzie Borden, you know that name, right? She was a famous female killer back in, I don't know, late 1800s or early 1900s. and how many killers must there have been all those years at all times? Yet I know the name Lizzie Borden.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think maybe for a long time, things like this stood out.
Well, why would that be? I mean, at the same time, in the late 1800s, presumably...
For the similar reasons, because, you know, it's like, it's the same thing, you know. Imagine, you know, we rewind the clock 600 years, and it's like, oh my gosh, you're not going to believe it. There was a raid in the town next door. It's like, yeah, yeah, I know, it sucks, but remember, there's raids like every few months around here. Okay. But the other one's like, dude, you're not going to believe it. Like, you know, Melinda, she just like brutally murdered her family. Like, that stands out.
Yeah.
So now we're going to tell a story about that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm saying that absolutely, novelty could be a factor. The other things I could think of is that she fits a story trope or a cultural trope, if you will, a cliche of the ultimate ex-girlfriend nightmare. Right. Mm. You remember this video around 10 years ago, I remember it was floating around where it became one of those first viral videos that I remember anyway. And this guy was in front of how it went down. He was in front of a whiteboard and he's just a regular guy or something. And he's talking about how there's this matrix or a graph that you can depict women on two axes. So these are all heterosexual women that he's talking about. And he's like,
oh, this sounds familiar.
Yeah. The axes are between good looks, how good looking she is. Well, anyway, I can't remember exactly how.
Yeah, but I remember the
video. But they were saying that the more good looking a woman gets, the crazier she has to be. And so there's a quadrant on the axes graph area that you can't have a woman that is both extremely hot, but is not crazy. Point is that...
It's so disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting and sexist, but it is absolutely an idea that's floated around by misogynists and society. You know, we could speculate as to why, but it's definitely not supported by the science.
Well, but there is one aspect that I think is this concept of, hey, this person is like really wild in bed, or you know, just very open, liberally sex, whatever. And they're also and then there's a whole bunch of other issues with them. Well, it is possible that people with more trauma, more abuse, more things happen to also have more extreme behaviors in general, which can include sexual behaviors. So people over time might generalize and say, yeah, that's a thing.
Right. So this is a trope. And I think it was particularly prevalent in really mainstream male culture 10 years ago. And this case slotted exactly into that, right?
Sure.
I mean, can you see how people would look at her that way?
Absolutely. They'd be like, well, there you go. That proves the theory.
Yeah, because we haven't gone into details, and we won't a lot, but there are a lot of graphic sexual details about this case.
Right, and the recordings of them talking together, her own descriptions about their relationship on the stand.
Yeah. I mean, it was... Yeah. Described in detail, so many data points.
And they had the pictures before the murder. Like, everything is just, like, on display.
Yeah, I mean, they literally had sex and took pictures of each other minutes before she was brutally murdering him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one hypothesis I would throw out there as to why our society is so fascinated by this case and others like it. Another is that it just involves sex. I mean, let's be honest. Anything that involves sex is something that society is going to talk about.
Right.
And also, there's this notion of the sexy woman, right, who commits a crime, Foxy Noxy in Italy, that kind of thing. And also, the fact that he's a religious man trying to be pure, and this attractive, sexy temptress, succubus comes in and you know, tempts him to the other side. Another factor that could be present is the brutality of the murder.
Yeah.
There are, you know, like we've been saying, probably daily murders like this, or at least weekly, or I don't know what the rate would be, but it's, you know, it's frequent. But often it's a gunshot to the head or just a couple stabs. But the brutality and the fact that we have like at least one picture of it happening at the time, you know, it's a picture gets taken accidentally, seemingly, by her while she's murdering him. And then also they released the pictures of his body in the shower when they found him a week later.
It's another one of those, like, how does that serve the public good? Imagine.
Yeah.
Like, where can I sign? Let me put this. Where can I sign to ask cops, media, everyone, like, please don't release pictures of me when I get brutally murdered. Like, just don't do it, please.
Well, there's this thing called prepaid legal, Berto. Have you heard of it?
I haven't, but tell me more. You sound very charismatic. I should follow you.
Another factor is sexism, pure and simple. Our society loves to attack women. And I don't know how to word it. Is it men trying to balance scales? You know, because there's a lot of men out there, the red pill people, the MGTOW incel people, that'll be like, well, you know, women abuse men too sometimes. And it's just like, yeah, totally. Absolutely. But, you know, it doesn't deny the fact that society is sexist. So when there's an example like this, it just gives the incels this massive amount of fuel to push back on what they believe to be unfair identification of sexism in society.
Absolutely. I call this the duck scale. Like, this has been going on for thousands of years, right? It's like, there's a witch. We can burn her. Yeah. You know?
I recently watched that movie. Another thing is, you know, racism. That it sounds counterintuitive, but the fact that white stories are told in the media and not other people's stories is another possibility. Another factor is potentially ageism, because, you know, most people at the time of this murder, they were older than Jodi Arias was.
Yeah.
And our society loves to look at, especially, I think, young women and find reasons to hate them.
Sure.
And so I think this could be another factor. And the final hypothesis I have is that, you know, you and I don't live in this world, but there's a religious world. And there are people that live in this religious world, and this is a philosophy or lifestyle that dominates their life, which is fine. And there are some people within the religious world that are in a constant battle trying to convince themselves to deny their carnal nature.
Right.
They are single and 20 years old, and they're being told that they can't have premarital sex. Or you have elders in the religious community that are trying to tell the younger people not to have sex. And
talk about a cautionary tale.
Yes. See? This is what we've been talking about.
I wonder if the Jodi trial is mandatory viewing in some diocese.
I mean, I would not be surprised that it's brought up, because it holds all of the markers, because she, you could argue, manipulated herself into the Mormon church just to be with him.
Yeah.
She was obsessed with it. He was, the way that the media portrays Travis is he was this, you know, this pillar of society, and he was loved by all, and he was a pure man, and this you know, Madonna whore thing, this you know, dirty, secular, non-religious outsider. She's from California, and she comes in and just completely overtakes him with her sexual...
their hunnish practices.
Yeah, with her attractiveness, and she seduces him, and then she kills him. And yeah, I mean, certainly she's an awful person, but if you frame it in a certain way of a cautionary tale, or if you've been really trying to convince the young kids not to have premarital sex or to not date people that aren't Mormon or not of your religion, you could see how this story would be a very convenient a selling point, if you will.
This is the don't drink and drive equivalent.
Yeah, right. So those are the theories. Let us know in the comment section if you have other ideas or comments about why these stories are so fascinating. Now, I will say that I'm fascinated with the story. So I'm not saying that there's something wrong with being fascinated with a story. I would like to think that I'm not fascinated with it for some of the problematic reasons that we've mentioned, but I do think that it is fascinating because of the brutality, and I guess because of the novelty, but also because of how much psychology is in this, and also just how many things that you can learn from this case as just someone in life. I think there's a lot to be learned about stalking, about how to respond to stalking, about how to help people when they're suffering, about you just never know, I guess, is kind of a thing.
Well, to me, one of the fascination, because I had a similar feeling watching all the Jodi interviews and the when she was talking and stuff that I had with the Casey stuff. And it's also the same feeling I've had watching some of the psychopaths we've talked about in the past. I'm not saying these are all psychopaths, but I'm saying that that feeling I get is this uneasiness of I like almost disbelief of how easy it comes to lie, and how I feel sort of helpless that I imagine myself confronting or interacting with a person like this and thinking, wow, reality and facts are not a thing that matters in this case. And you can tell me whatever you want without caring that what that means to me or what it might, how it might hurt me. Or it's like, it's a little scary. It's frightening. So there is that fascination for me. Maybe it's a morbid fascination, but it is a fascination of, wow, these are real human brains and this is how they work.
Yeah, I'll add it. Fascination with psychopaths. I think another, as a subset of that, another possibility that popped into my head is that in a weird way, you know, the similar way as to why we might like horror movies or mafia mob movies is that we get to play out our potential fantasies of getting revenge against someone that broke up with us, getting revenge against someone who broke up with us. You got to find out how slowly I type right now. And that sounds abhorrent and not very likely, but I think that there's a possibility that subconsciously while we're watching this, in a similar way that when we're watching, like I said, a horror movie or a mafia movie, that we get a subconscious satisfaction watching someone else do what we wouldn't actually want to do, but we have feelings that are of anger and revenge that we wouldn't want to murder our past partners, but we would want to get back at them. We would want to humiliate them.
So it's interesting because I have this sort of 180 degree different reaction when I'm watching a horror movie. I hate to admit it, but oftentimes I am under the surface, not explicitly, but I'm sort of rooting for the bad guy in the horror movie. In the sense that that's kind of what the plot of the movie is. You're seeing this psycho killer kill more. And so there's that part of my brain that's like, okay, how is he going to keep killing more, right? Now, obviously the conscious and moral part of me goes like, well, no, obviously we want this to stop. That's when I'm watching a horror movie. What's interesting is when I'm watching these cases, a lot of my subconscious fantasy it steers towards the other aspect, which is how I want to get revenge on this criminal. Like, right. And like, oh, I would torture them for years. And then I have to fight against myself too, going like, no, stop. You know that's like throwing your life away to think that way.
Because you grew up with the drug cartels in Bogota.
I was the enforcer. They called me el enforcito.
Who were terrorizing your community. Yeah. And you literally had bullets going.
Right. So you're right. So I had a lot of time to fantasize about how unjust that was and how much I wish justice would come to these people.
That Superman would come down and throw them into the ocean or something. And so that's another thing. And I think that's another reason why we like mob movies, mafia movies, and horror movies. And I think stories like this is because we both get the satisfaction from both sides. We both get the satisfaction of getting revenge on our former partners. And we get the satisfaction of watching the bully get a consequence. You know, the story for Jody Arias doesn't end well.
Well, and I would say, because like, for example, the Casey story, I don't think there was any part of me that was like, ooh, this is how I would get back at my kid or something, right? That's a horrendous thought. But there was definitely that thought of like, how could I get back at this monster?
Right.
And in a mob movie, I'm like, oh, how can Tony Soprano get away with it? At the same time, me kind of rooting for him to get caught, but not really. But
Totally. Yeah. So, Berto, in this chapter, we're going to be going into the relationship and all the details between Travis and Jody. Mm-hmm. The love bombing, the back and forth, the religious aspects, the sexual aspects, the stalking. And in this chapter, we'll probably end up getting to the details of the murder, which I spent a lot of time going over the data and also reading a lot of people's hypotheses about what really happened. Because none of us really know what happened during the murder, but there's a lot of evidence to pore over. And I found someone that had hypothesized about the different events. And also there's the prosecution's narrative. And it explains a lot, because there's a lot of blood. There's a lot of also the cleanup. And there's also some theories that I came across that actually felt a lot more satisfying, like the fact that she put the camera in the washing machine and she's also a professional photographer. So she probably knew about how those things work. And also, she could have just brought the camera with her, right? Yeah. She brought the knife and the gun with her. Why wouldn't she bring the camera? And so, because at first...
I have a theory on that one.
Yeah, and I do too. And it's interesting that at first, because I think most people just think that she's a dumb girl who didn't understand that just putting it in the washing machine wouldn't necessarily do anything. But it's interesting that we would think that instead of trying to figure out some other answer. And especially when you consider she's a professional photographer, or she really studied photography and grew up with digital photography, probably knew a lot about it, a lot more than maybe even you and I know about it. So probably did know a lot more than you and I. So anyway, we're going to go over all that, but this episode is just going to be for patrons of the podcast, because usually when I spend many days prepping for an episode and spending a lot of time on it, I like to really reward the patrons with that, because the only reason why I can even spend that amount of time is because they literally pay my bills, so I don't have to work the university, so I can spend 16 hours a day for a number of days just studying the Jodi Arias data, of which there is so much to go over. And I almost wanted to postpone this episode to next week, because I wanted maybe so another week to go over everything, but I figured I'd just pull the ripcord and let it rip. So, Berto, in one sentence, why should people become a patron of the podcast and listen to this episode?
Well, besides to support my Coke habit, because I don't like Pepsi anymore, I think there is a wealth of great, great content. If you care about psychology, if you care about some serious deep dives, like collegiate, you know, like the kind of thing you would read in a book that you bought for $600 from the library at Stanford, you know, like really important stuff, plus a lot of BS coming from my mouth. But it's really interesting topics all over the place. Like, we've covered almost everything. That's important. But if you like it and you want to see it keep going, support it.
Yeah, literally. It's the only way we can keep going. And become a patron. But otherwise, the episode will end now, and take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.
All right, welcome to the Patron Zone, patrons. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Hahn. I'm a therapist and a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I sell handkerchiefs that never get dirty.
So let's get into the relationship. Starts in 2006, when she's about 26 and he's about 29, and they meet at this conference for the prepaid legal. She is a new pyramid scheme worker.
Yeah.
And he is top dog, or at least one of the top dogs. He's the charismatic leader, the talker, the seller.
This is so funny, because so I knew that she had met him at some conferences and that she had been impressed by his ability to speak and his charisma, blah, blah. I just hadn't connected the dots between those things.
Well, because they don't highlight it.
Yeah.
If he were the perpetrator, they would have highlighted that, I'm guessing. Yeah. And I get it, because you don't want to besmirch him, or why do that?
Sure.
And plus, I'm not even sure if I'm characterizing any of this right, but it certainly looks that way to me.
But, you know, because I mentioned it before, it's so interesting that one clip I saw, it is this, it actually encapsulates that whole industry in my mind. The sentiment was, you know, you have to go out and make 100 calls, right? Because that says, look, you are going to have to put in some work. But then the selling point is, by the time you're at the 10th call or whatever number it is, you won't know how to spend your money. And that is that industry. That is, they listen, I'm not going to lie to you, there's some work involved at first. But pretty soon, you're going to be unimaginably wealthy.
Yeah. And if it's a sales inspiration meeting, sometimes you need that inspiration, right? But when you're selling a bill of goods that is not likely to deliver and everyone knows it, then you're talking about fraud, which is why these things are illegal. And again, I could be speaking out of my butt about this whole industry and about this, or about this company, but that was the allegation, that it's a pyramid scheme.
All right. I think, sorry, but that is the difference, though, between the motivational version of that says, like, you got to make 100 calls. 99 of those calls, you're not going to get a bite. The 100th one, you will. And after that, you're going to start to learn how to sell.
Right.
Okay, great. Like, that happened to me, blah, blah. Absolutely. But when you're like, you won't know what to do, you won't know how to spend your money.
Yeah.
That's where you're defrauding
people. Yeah, not likely. Not likely. All right, so she goes to the conference in Vegas. She sees him talk. He's very charismatic. And Travis is a flirt. And actually, Travis hit on her. He went up to her. Mm. thinking she was attractive and asked her on a date. I mean, the way they talked about it, he just walked up to her and they chatted for a second. And then he said, can I take you to the conference ball tonight, the dinner tonight? And they have this date, or they date during this conference. And the next morning.
And by the way, I wouldn't underplay the fact that, like we were saying before, Mormon kids grow up learning how to approach strangers and present to them some very complex, difficult topics to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
With confidence.
Yeah. And my understanding of Mormon congregations is there's a lot of opportunity for socializing.
Yeah.
And you learn how to be charming, I suppose. Yeah. Not all, but you just wonder. And for the record, I grew up in Issaquah and Sammamish, where there was a sizable minority of the kids who were Mormon. On the top of my head, anecdotally, I would say maybe 10-15% of my classmates and friends were Mormon.
Yeah.
I grew up with a lot of them, and I can tell you anecdotally that a lot of them, and they were good friends of mine, were very charming.
Yeah.
Very good at knowing, not in a manipulative way, but just very socially adept.
Look, for the record, I have never personally ever had a bad experience with a Mormon person or family.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
They've always been extremely welcoming to me, very nice, and like you said, very personable, very all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So they have a date, and the next morning he wakes up and tells one of his friends who gave this statement during an interview, that he said that he wanted to marry her.
Mm.
And they seemingly and possibly love bombed each other from the very beginning. The temptation is to say she love bombed him, but it's possible that they love bombed each other, which does happen.
My understanding, you might be going into this, but my understanding of his childhood is he had a lot of attachment issues.
Yeah.
And so it was quite possible that he would love bomb her.
So let's talk about Travis's childhood. So he's born 1977 in California, a few years older than Jody. His childhood, we have more details, but not a lot, but some details from his siblings. Travis grew up in a very, very poor household. Both of his parents were quote-unquote drug addicts, and he talked about this. He had a very, very difficult childhood, him and his siblings, you know, terribly neglected. Oof. His mom, he said, would fall asleep for several days, and he and his brothers had to fend for themselves.
Oh my God.
No food in the house, and dad wasn't around. Eventually, Travis runs away. I don't know at what age, but it probably wasn't when he was very young. But eventually, he runs away to his grandparents, and for the most part, I think his grandparents raised him from that point forward. Very, very common story. As I was talking about in the last chapter, I worked with a third of my clients in my early career was with teenagers, and a fair amount of them had backstories like this, and a fair amount of them were currently like this, where the parents were in the process of trying to get the kids back, or they recently had the kid taken away, and I would work with parents like this, and it was a really difficult situation. From the outside, it seems like, how come the state doesn't step in? You know, it's really complicated because the government is really hesitant to strip away the sacred rights of a parent.
Yeah.
Because the government just doesn't want to interfere. Yeah. The government might even recognize, like, that's a bad situation, but if we start intervening and stuff like that, there's millions of households that we would have to intervene. And one, that's not how our current law works. And two, we don't have the money to do that kind of thing because taxes aren't allocated. So anyway, I was involved with a lot of families like this, and a really unfortunate common story. There are households in our town, in the town that you're listening to, dear listener, where this is currently happening, where kids are barely getting by. The parents are in and out of consciousness and are using, you know, because you fall into a hole of addiction, it really becomes your life.
Yeah, no force on earth can stop you.
Yeah.
Your kids, nothing.
Yeah. So it's a really sad situation. And in all likelihood, Travis's parents were traumatized themselves and neglected themselves. But anyway, so he gets raised by his grandparents, and he's raised Mormon. He's very devout, very into the full Mormon thing, the chastity, the purity, no sex before marriage, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, so that's his background. And in all likelihood, as I was hypothesizing about Jody in the last chapter, now we have two people who don't have their attachment needs met.
Yeah.
And massive amount of attachment security, massive amount of need. And if given a chance to feel attachment secure, they're going to go for it, right?
Sure.
So they meet each other. Now, let's talk about love bombing for a second, Bruno. So what do you think love bombing is in your mind?
Well, the way I experienced it anyways was multiple long letters written to me in a given day expressing how unbelievably amazing and miraculous I am.
Are you talking about a specific experience?
Yeah, this is a specific experience.
Okay.
And constant praise and adulation.
I mean, for the record, you just never wrote me back, so I kept writing.
I know, dude, but I was embarrassed. And then just like every moment spent with that person, you are made to feel like you are like the best thing to happen in the history of humanity. And so, you know, anyways. So
how do they communicate that you're the best thing?
Both through time spent with you, the feeling that everything else is on hold for you. In my case, like I said, it was long form letters, but nowadays it would be like probably a lot of text messages.
And how did it make you feel?
It made me feel like redeemed by life. Like, okay, I guess I am worth it.
Mm.
I guess the abandonment issues I felt, I mean, I'm obviously, but in my mind, it must have been, little Berto must have been going, oh, wait a minute, maybe we have this wrong.
Right. Because when you're 4, you're supposed to have that kind of love.
Right.
You deserve that kind of love.
Right.
And if you don't get that love when you're 0 to 5, and someone comes along and gives you that kind of love, not consciously, of course, but you will feel suddenly worth it, as you say, and fulfilled and safe and finally home, finally where you deserve to be, unconditional, unbridled. You know, because when you think about a parent with an infant, say a 1-month-old child or a 6-month-old child, that parent, rightfully so, is obsessed with that human being.
Absolutely.
Their entire life revolves around that little raisin of a human. Every breath, every movement, the first time an infant laughs at you, or literally the thousandth time the infant laughs at you, the parent is beside themselves.
And the infant is seeing that feedback, right? They're like, even though they're not capturing it all with letters and words, but they're seeing it and going, mental note, I make any sound, this thing is obsessed over my little sounds and smile that does this big facial thing that I love and it touches me and
I've evolved to supremely desire that face to do that.
and then as I do start getting language, any little thing I do, like, hey, look at this song I just came, everything is met with, oh my gosh, that's the best thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. And you're just getting all that love and all that attention, hopefully. And, you know, the parent, they can't think about anything else. The infant smells like manna from heaven. You know, I just want to smell this baby. Now, arguably all babies smell like manna from heaven, but, you know, particularly to the parent, right?
Right.
The kid is the smartest, the best, you know, they're obsessed. And of course, we think, well, that's good parenting. But if you don't get that, then you forever want that. And when you finally get that in the form of love bombing, then it feels very good. So for people that haven't had that fulfillment early in life sufficiently, they're very much susceptible to love bombing, you know. Now, love bombing will affect anyone. Everyone wants adoration and attention and unconditional love. But if it's the first time you've ever had it in your life, then the victim or the target of love bombing will do a lot of things to retain that, right? Yeah. Which we'll get into. So,
and by the way, there's one thing about, like, okay, maybe you meet someone and maybe they do quote unquote love bomb you for a couple of days. Maybe you do too, because, you know, it's a brand new relationship. But the idea is it should start stabilizing a little bit and like start regulating a little bit.
Well, not by definition, which I'll get into here in a second, but to put a fine point on that, there'd be nothing wrong. And of course, the heuristic is that there is something wrong with it, but there'd be nothing wrong. It'd be unusual. It'd be nothing wrong with a couple or one member of a couple having that infatuation for years and years of a relationship. But
that's great. But here's what's not okay. When 2 months later, it flips 180 degrees and you're the worst thing ever in the history of humanity.
Right. But but I want to point out the common culture heuristic of that is often true, that kind of obsessive infatuation, if prolonged, usually is associated with bad things, as we'll get into. But in and of itself, it's, and I feel like a lot of times people are afraid of it. You know, you find a friend who is falling in love, and you can't relate because you don't know the person they're falling in love with, or you're not in love with the person they're falling in love with. And there's this suspiciousness about it, like, Jesus Christ, you're just so infatuated. And it could be a problem, but it could also just be falling in love. There's nothing wrong with being infatuated.
Right. It's just that, you know, like, having experienced both kind of versions of it, there's one version where you are pretty obsessed. Like, from an outsider looking in with no context, might think, oh, whoa, those two are love bombing each other. But there's a, first of all, it's mutual, and there's come a natural balancing point. Here's the fact.
A common balancing point, right, is, but not necessarily natural or inherently necessary.
Right. It's probably true for most people that you physically can't reply to 6,000 messages a day and continue living and working and doing everything else you need to be doing.
Well, if it's interfering with your life.
But it would be interfering with
your life. But I think you're giving in to the cultural heuristic, which is a shortcut
trying to
detect love bombing.
I think you're exaggerating. I think what I'm saying is that there is a natural thing that happens in a new relationship. Common thing that happens in a new relationship, which is obsession.
Yeah.
And I've experienced it without the bad parts.
Yeah.
I think the obsession, for it to be sustainable, needs to balance out to something more that you can actually do the rest of your life.
So two types of love bombing that I have identified, and most people don't really identify, they don't talk about it. Usually the types of love bombing, or the type of love bombing that is proposed or discussed, and it's rarely, you know, defined well, but is the first type that I'll identify, which is a conscious attempt. So love bombing is a conscious attempt, meaning it's volitional. People wake up in the morning, they're like, I'm going to love bomb this person. They don't necessarily word it that way, but they are trying to manipulate and control the other person using grand demonstrations of affection. So that's the, what we might call the psychopathic, the Machiavellian love bombing. It's out there and it happens. Cults will do this. Psychopaths will do this. Certainly, con artists will do this. Other people will do this. But it's rare in terms of all the cases of love bombing in my experience and in my model of human life. The second type is much more common, which is a subconscious effort to gain attachment security through hasty and extreme affection. So I think that for the sake of this discussion, for at least Jodi Arias, she was in all likelihood doing this. Possible that he was either a very willing participant and recipient, or he was actually doing it as well, given his attachment disruptions. So the idea goes is that for Jodi, given, you know, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, so it's hard to say, but given the possibility that she at least had a pretty severe case of preoccupied attachment and maybe moderate borderline. And the reason why I don't say severe is because more severe borderline individuals will have much more global problematic behaviors, which she didn't seem to exhibit, but we only have reports from a lot of witnesses. But anyway, so it's possible that she desperately wants to have attachment security, has never really felt it, has a model of understanding or predicting relationships that is, unless that she's not lovable, that she's going to be rejected, she's going to be betrayed, she's going to be cheated on, she's going to be left. And so when she finds someone, you know, and the first night on a date, and they've had a couple of drinks maybe or something, and they're in Vegas, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. She was, you know, a very attractive young woman, and he's the charismatic guy, and she probably presents well at the gala.
Right.
And so he's just like, oh my God. And then given her, so here's another part of it, another angle of this profile of Jodi is that I can't know this, and I don't want to go down this road, partially because I don't want to fall into a sexist, misogynistic trope of highlighting or emphasizing her as being a slut or something. So I'm not saying that, but this is a well-known thing, regardless of gender, that for some people, when they are desperate for attachment security, they will utilize whatever skills or traits or things that they're good at, right? So if it's intelligence, if it's money or sexuality, and there are plenty of men who do this as well. And this isn't just a woman thing by any means, but if you are really desperate for attention, you're really desperate for acceptance, and you don't mind chameleonizing yourself, and you really want people to need you and want you, then you might subconsciously even lean into certain traits and certain strengths of yours, like your sexuality, like your looks. You might become, even again, subconsciously, very good at having sex, very good at being sexy.
Right.
And you don't really know who you are. You don't have a sense of your identity. So you're looking for someone to become. And if someone wants you to be a sexual dynamo, and by being a sexual dynamo, which is no skin off your back because you don't know who you are and it's not against your character because you don't feel like you have one. And by being a sexual dynamo, it means that you will retain someone's obsession and attention and acceptance and quote-unquote love, then you're all for it. And so this hapless Mormon guy who's trying to be pure, and who knows how much sex he had prior to Jody. I have a feeling he wasn't always quote-unquote pure, as they were talking about in the various documentaries and
statements. It's hard to know, but in either case, he was trying.
He was trying. He was one of those people who was very much dedicated, really trying to remain chaste and pure, and wanted to potentially marry someone that was chaste and pure, not only just for appearances, but because literally your eternal life might depend on it, that kind of thing, you know? And so who knows, but maybe even that first night, there was a lot of sensuality.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like they had sex the first time, but there's plenty of evidence of what you were saying. Like, you know, Jody's lawyer accused her of trying to seduce him.
Oh, really?
Prison guards. Oh, yeah. There's lots of evidence that she absolutely has tried to use her sexuality.
I mean, I did hear the prison guard one.
Yeah.
Because she was disciplined, I think, on the record for getting into a conflict with a guard, calling him a cock blocker, which I was trying to figure that one out. And I'm like, okay, if she's accusing a guard of being a cock blocker and you're in a women's prison, then whose cock is the guard blocking?
Another guard.
Another guard.
Yeah.
Another staff member.
And like I said, the lawyer, her lawyer. Not the prosecutor, the lawyer.
Her own lawyer.
Her own lawyer.
That guy with the shaved head.
Yeah, he asked to be taken off the case.
Well, I knew that.
And he accused her of trying to seduce him.
Wow. I mean, I read that he had a lot of... Was he the one that wrote the book?
I don't know.
One of them wrote a book and published it and talked about how much they really disliked working with... Being Jody Arias's lawyer.
Right. Probably him.
Now, these were court-appointed... So they are kind of forced onto the case, and they repeatedly, the lawyers tried to get off of the case because they had conflicts with her because she was not complying. She was lying to them and making it really hard for them to do their job. But I didn't know that she was trying to seduce them. Yeah. And you could argue that the videotape of the interrogation with the cops, it's not overt seduction. You could almost say what she was doing with the cops, and I was like, I'll just watch a couple minutes of this.
No, I watched the whole thing.
I watched
multiple times.
Yeah, hours of her talking to the police officer when she's initially and in subsequent interrogations.
I don't know if you have the same thing. I have the same effect when I watch Curb Your Enthusiasm or It's Always Sunny.
Yeah.
Of this embarrassment where I'm like, you know you're lying.
Well,
and you know that they know you're lying. You should know that they know you're... And it's just that feeling inside of me of like, oh God, I can't... Like, but it's irresistible too.
Yeah. But with the Jody Arias stuff, I would have to look away at times because I was just like, this is uncomfortable. But what I think she was doing with the cop was trying to act like a child.
Yeah.
She was trying to evoke his paternal nature.
Yeah. And there's a lot of postures and things where it's like, that's a little kid.
Yeah. And the topics and the tone of voice. So that's that chameleonizing. Now, some people say it's psychopathic, and I don't know. I think it's learned. I think she doesn't even necessarily know she's doing it some of the times, but she could. Anyway, so...
By the way, there was a weird thing in that where she said, when she said, the guy's like, I could show you the photos. And she goes, oh, I kind of want to see them. I mean, part of me doesn't, but part of me does, which I did get a little weird psychopathic vibe about, or at least sadist vibe.
I think, and this is a very common thing for perpetrators who are being questioned by the cops. So one of the things that I've heard from interrogators, detectives, that one of the things that they can use against criminals, guilty criminals who are trying to act innocent, is they will bait the perpetrator with data, with evidence.
Right.
Because the accused will really want...
I want to see your cards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to see what you got so sure. I know how to respond. And the interrogator, the detective, doesn't want to show them their cards because they want to push the accused into a corner where they have to say something that is provably not true, right?
So that makes a lot of sense. What's funny about it, not funny in a real funny way, just a horrifying way, is you would think if the person was fully putting the whole thing together in their head, they would be like, okay, I know I want to see the data, but if I say, oh, I don't know, I just have a morbid curiosity, isn't that going to sound horrible? So maybe I should just keep my mouth shut.
Well, also, she is overtly being accused at this point.
Yeah.
And she stays engaged and doesn't ask for a lawyer, which is another thing that a lot of detectives will look at. It's not a for sure thing, but you know, most of the time when it switches from we're just gathering information to now we're accusing you, most people will be like, oh, crap.
Didn't she have prepaid law services?
That's funny. That's a good one. Good connection there. Okay. So, love bombing. Again, two types. You have the sadistic, psychopathic, con artist type, manipulative, consciously manipulative. And the key is that a person is trying to manipulate and control someone using grand demonstrations of affection, or there's a subconscious version of trying to gain attachment security. They're trying to gain what we all want and deserve, but they are doing it subconsciously by racing towards the finish line.
Yeah,
they want to be fully enmeshed, fully connected, fully married, fully locked in, and they want it now. And they want you completely. You know, think about someone that's more securely attached and they go on a date and they're just like, whoa, that was a good date.
Yeah.
Wow, I mean that felt really good. But inside of themselves, they're not 1,000,000,000% desperate. They're like, this could be the one, but I don't know. I mean, but oh, that felt so good. But they go home and they go to bed and they go to work and they think about other things. You know, there's not there's some thinking about it, but it's not like all consuming. You know, it's sort of the analogy is like you're in a burning building and you don't know the way out and there's smoke everywhere. And then all of a sudden you see a light,
right?
Sunlight. Well, you're not going to sit there and wonder about your taxes that you have to pay next month. All you're thinking about is running toward the light. Right. You don't care even what gets in your way. Like a dog could get in your own pet could get in the way. And you know, if you're desperate enough, you'll just, and so if you are attachment insecure in the way that I believe both of them were, particularly her, then you're not stopping at go.
Now, you're racing. Look, to your point earlier, there is a societal expectation that you shouldn't, you know, the whole thing, like don't call her back. Like don't, you know, don't write that message. Like, you're supposed to pretend you're not that interested, right? I'm not saying that's good, but that's the societal expectation.
You're supposed to pretend
that you're not that interested.
It's lying. It's playing a game.
Okay, fair enough. At the same time, though, wouldn't you agree that there's a little bit of a human element that we want to be wanted, but we don't want someone desperate?
Desperation
isn't attractive.
We don't want to be pressured. And also, we don't want someone desperate. We don't want to... Especially in the beginning, we don't want to date someone that seems to be having experienced a lot of rejection. And thus you go, well, why have they been rejected so often?
And look, and I'm not trying to die on this hill. It's just to my point earlier, 7 weeks into a new relationship, I may not be in the mood to reply to 1,000 messages like I was the first few weeks. But what you're trying to get at is that with some of these attachment disorder folk, they kind of have blinders on. They're like, I don't care. I need this and I need it fully and I'm going to do everything. And if they are charismatic enough, good looking enough, whatever, they get away with it for some amount of time before the other person, especially if the other person doesn't have the right, maybe because they also might have attachment disorder.
Yeah. You know? So it's a red flag.
Yeah.
It's not an indication. And I will die in this hill because there are plenty of couples that pass a certain point, particularly Americans, maybe, I don't know, that will purposely be suspicious of themselves or their partner or their friends when there are overt, mushy expressions of love beyond a certain threshold. And that heuristic is, or that red flag identification is fine. But the notion that we can't be vulnerable and in love and expressive.
Yeah, but that's different, man. There's a difference between that and like, why didn't you answer my text message?
I'm talking about affection, my friend. That's all I'm talking about. That's the basis of the love. You know, when we see the two of them in love that first night, there's no threats. There's no pressure.
Wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. It's just that, you know.
And love bombing involves.
I'm friends with you. But would you be okay if I texted you all the time every day about how much I love you as a friend?
If you didn't mind me not replying.
Yeah, you might be like, hey, can no. you cut down the text
if that's how
bit?
You want to, if that's a, but at the same, but it would only be a problem if I felt pressured.
Sure.
That's the problem.
I think there's, there
you're free
some
to express yourself.
Because the other person might start going like, you know, I send you messages all the time.
So?
And you don't get back to me.
So the solution is shut down affection entirely?
No, the solution is,
okay.
You still have
that's
to
all I'm
your
saying.
Life.
Is like, we have a stupid theme yeah. or string in our society.
The,
like,
I don't,
those people are showing,
100%.
Like you'll see a couple that's 5 years into the relationship and they're googly eyes at each other's and holding hands. And people will be like, that's weird. That's creepy. Literally, people will say it's
and
creepy.
That's stupid that they say that.
Yeah.
I agree with you. 100%. Okay.
So the cycle of love bombing is they shower you with love. Now, I want to be clear that, so, and maybe I'll start with the ending here, which is that there's a difference between being in love, having affection, and love bombing. And the key differences are that the target, when the target wants to push back a little bit or slow down, the love bomber will, at the very, you know, for the most part, they'll let it happen. They might be a little hurt, a little disappointed, but there's not the pressure that you will see in love bombing, not the consequence that you will get from love bombers. The second thing is that love bombers, by definition, and my definition, is that the affection is not unconditional. Their love has conditions. You know what I mean? They're
right.
They need you to be a certain way. You know, when you aren't love bombing and you're having infatuated love for someone and you're mostly securely attached or you've been through a lot of therapy and your partner, say, doesn't text you back or is like, well, I don't know if I really want to talk about moving in together. You know,
yeah,
say it's a few months. You still love that person.
Right.
But to the love bomber, it's not love, like respectful love. It's demanding love. It's you need to be this certain
it's
person
transactional.
Or else.
Yeah.
I will love you if you agree
right.
with the pace that I need you to go at. The third thing is that they respond relatively well to your criticisms when the non-love bomber will respond well to your criticisms, right? So when you say, you're kind of, not just about love bombing, you just say, you know, you're kind of, you have a hard time with criticism. Or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And the non-love bomber, relatively speaking, will react okay to that. To the love bomber, you're not being the person that they need you to be.
Yeah.
You're threatening the fantasy that they need to have, or they're trying to manipulate you into sadistically. And the fourth thing is that with a non-love bomber, you will not have a deep down fear of them. And that's one of the keys is that is that with love bombing, when you're being love bombed, you probably won't notice it very overtly, is you will be afraid. And you will notice that your fear will go down when you comply.
I've talked about this before when I just started at UW, so I was a freshman, and there was this guy I met who was maybe a year older than me or something, very charismatic, good-looking dude, seemed awesome, and he just approached me randomly and just struck up a conversation, and he just seemed great, and he seemed so interested in what I was about, what I was studying, all these things, and then he invited me to, you know, get together, a party on Friday. And I went to the party. Well, it turns out it was for a religious group. It was a highly religious group. Now, the guy, I didn't get any weird, scary vibes from it. But I did realize when I arrived at the party and I saw what this was really about is that it was a recruitment thing. And at that moment, I don't know if my feeling was of sadness, but there was definitely a feeling of, and again, it's not fear, but it was a feeling of tension. Like, oh no. Now I owe something in this relationship, but I don't want to be here. But they were so nice to me.
Right. It's subtle.
Yeah.
It's threatening people with kindness. It's weird. Yeah. And you can't put a finger on it, but you know there will be a negative consequence. There will be anger or rejection or a withdrawal of something. Something bad is going to happen to me if I don't go along with this. Anyway, so the cycle of love bombing, Berto, is they first begin to shower you with love and affection, compliments. They communicate often. With Jody and Travis, there's this statistic that they keep identifying, 82,000 emails.
Yeah.
So when you heard that, them talking about how, and presumably this is just within the main portion of their 5 month relationship.
Right, right.
So 82, when you hear that, what do you think?
Well, I've sort of been there before. It's kind of what I was saying. What I was saying is that at first it's all you can do and the rest of your day is gone to crap because you just end up replying nonstop to more and more messages, but it feels fun. It's like, wow. You know, it's like a whole new world. You're discover, everything is a new discovery. You're, I can't believe you're into that too. Oh my God. And then it's like, and plus the, wow, I have never heard music like yours, art like yours, stories like
yeah.
You're validated on every level. If you have gripes of wrath about anything, they're like, absolutely. Oh my gosh, what a terrible person. What a terrible situation. What a terrible. And so, yeah, it's like addicting.
Yeah. Now, if you stretch 82,000 emails over 2 years, which is roughly the time that they met until he died. That's about 120, 150 emails a day, which is still a lot. But when you think about, you know, just the way that they might have been communicating, it's not that much. So with love bombing, they shower you with love. There's also a lot of communication. They might offer to save you. There's gifts, that kind of thing. There's big emotions usually of love and happiness and joy and sex and lust. They usually move very quickly in love bombing and they're pushy about it. You will feel often obligated to please them. So you feel obligated and you will agree to do things that you wouldn't normally agree to and you're afraid of pushing back. So in a love bombing with Jodi Arias, maybe it's like, hey honey, I love you. Do you love me? And you know, you haven't gotten back to me.
Yeah.
And I just love you so much. You know, on the surface, it can be like, wow, you know, she really loves me, or wow, okay, she just, you know, she wants me to tell her I love her.
Yeah.
But you feel the energy, you feel the desperation, and you feel the pressure.
Yep.
You know that if you don't deliver, whatever is behind that desperation is gonna explode.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Even if you don't know it consciously, you're feeling it.
Right. And that's often with love bombing at this early phase is you feel it, you know it.
By the way, I also wonder, because with people like myself, and it sounds like Travis, you know, with attachment disorder to some extent, he probably had it much worse, but where you're also afraid that people will leave you and abandon you forever.
Right. Yeah.
So saying no is not just about this person's weirdness, is that might mean you will never have friends or family again.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I will contend that I would hypothesize that he might have had an avoidant attachment style, and these individuals are just as attachment desperate as people who are preoccupied like Jodi, mm-hmm. but they deny it and they desperately want to be close. And one of the only ways they can get close is if someone invades them and like a preoccupied person. So they need that. And also they project their clinginess into that person because they deny their own emotionality. And so
that's who knows? Match made in.
Right. But it's a frequent configuration. I don't have much evidence that he was like that. There's some, which we'll get into there. So then the other thing as we move through the cycles is, so all these things are present, the big emotions, the affection, the compliments, the love, you will feel an obligation. You become completely enmeshed with each other where your lives are completely overlapped. And this, up till this point, aside from the you will feel obligated or them being pushy, this could just be a healthy falling in love. There's a honeymoon phase. Then there's the end of the honeymoon phase, which is normal. You know, a little bit of a dropping off, as we were talking about earlier, common for after, I don't know, a little bit of time, a few months or whatever, for things to kind of start to cool off a little bit. Then at this point, there's a vulnerability to the love bomber for the subconscious one, the attachment disruption one, where there isn't a constant flow of indication of attachment, security, and full dedication. And something will happen that'll trigger them.
Yeeks.
Maybe it'll be the distance. Maybe you had a long day at work and you couldn't reply with texts. Maybe you have a conversation where they're like, hey, I think we should move in together. And you're just like, okay, well, yeah, maybe in a few months we can talk about it. You're up for it, but you're not immediately right up for it. That triggers them. Then they will all good, all bad you.
Mm.
And then they're extremely hurt because of their traumas. You are all bad and they start attacking you. And that could be abuse, or it could be emotional attacking or something. And long story short, with this phase, eventually you're as a target of love bombing, you're just like, yeah, maybe this relationship isn't working out. Or you start to kind of, you know, because at first you're like, no, but then they attack, and maybe there's some cycles within this cycle where they recover, but eventually you get wary as a target, right. And you start to say, you know what, I don't think we should be together, or maybe even you break up. Then the person will all good you, because if they continue to, this is subconscious, if they right. continue to all bad
then
you,
then it's a permanent break. Yeah,
they can't have that, so they defensively idealize. Essentially the ego is saying, you have to idealize them, otherwise you're really going to lose them.
Yeah.
So then the idealization happens, they shower you with love, they apologize probably or something like that. They might even say, I need you, let's have what we used to have. And you remember. You remember how good it was in the right. beginning. And you still have your attachment issues that are not being satisfied yet by someone else. And so you're once again getting that old person back. Oh my God.
And they might compromise at that point. They might say, look, I'll drive to you. You can see other people. You know, whatever.
Right.
They might compromise on the surface.
Depending, yeah. For sure.
Because they're bargaining to see if they can get you back.
Right. And really accommodating in ways that they weren't earlier or something. And you might even feel obligated to please them, because you're like, well, look what all the things they're doing. You know, I've never had someone that really did all this stuff to try to get me back. I mean, look how much they love me. That must have been an anomaly what happened. We're talking about things, so everything must be fixed, right? So why wouldn't I go back? This feels so good. You go back and the cycle continues.
Yeah.
So that's love bombing in the subconscious sense. And so it seems that that's what Jody did with Travis.
Right.
There's not a ton of evidence at this early phase, but you can definitely kind of see the residual of it in the future when he starts to draw boundaries.
Yeah.
And she just starts to pour it on. You could argue that the phone sex and that kind of stuff.
But the anecdotes from the friends, though, indicated that even when they were going out,
And
of course, friends can be biased, right? But their opinion was like, oh, she's so jealous, and this seems like, you know, kind of a control issue or something.
Well, and very clingy. One report from the friends that they got in a hot tub together, friends, and she was all over him and all lovey-dovey. And the friends were like, oh my God, this is so awkward, because, and he's just sitting there going like, this is, you know, I don't feel comfortable, but I don't want to reject her. And maybe it feels good that she's glomming all over me. And it's what felt creepy. They didn't use that word, but it felt extremely awkward and out of place. If they were alone in the hot tub, fine. Or if all of us were having an orgy, fine. But we're all just sitting in a hot tub having a conversation while we're watching one person just sexually and sensually go to town someone else.
Right.
And it's hard not to be uncomfortable with it. Yeah. And she didn't seem to care. Or she was trying to manipulate the situation of saying, like, he's all mine, don't look at him.
Right.
Or whatever. But yeah, that just obsession. And for him, that might have been very ego gratifying of just like, I've never had a woman that just couldn't keep her hands off me and just wanted me all to herself and didn't have anything else in her life. You know, that feels very secure. She needs me. It feels like she'll never leave me, which is a very nice feeling. That's the seduction of that.
You know, I wonder because, so some of my experience is that my wife, I was going to say my current wife, I've only had one wife. My wife is not a clingy person and she never was with me. And I actually think that's one of the things that ultimately attracted me to her, is that I I have experienced clinginess, and there is that little child of me that wanted it. But when I was actually experiencing it past a certain point, a different feeling set in, which was, it's weird. Like I actually, for example, I don't like getting hugs, like tight hugs. I don't feel comfortable with it. And I don't know what that is, but whatever that is, I would start feeling that way. I'm like, oh, I don't like that. That's uncomfortable. And I wonder if that's the abuse part or something. I don't know. But whatever that was, it didn't actually feel good after a certain point. Whereas my mind would have been saying, oh, this is great. You're getting your attention. And there was that surface level of like, ooh, I'm the man. Look at all this attention I'm getting. Mm-hmm. But inside, there was another part, which was... So I'm wondering what was going through this person's mind, Travis's mind, in a situation like that. If it was all good or if it was a mix of emotions.
My impression was that it was all good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because even, and we'll get into it, even after there was some really strong indication that there was something going on there with her stalking and sneaking around and being a very unsafe person, he continued to date her. So.
He did, but he did talk to his, and again, this is later, he did talk to his friends about sort of like not wanting to, but not being able to not. You right. know? Which sounds a little like addictive.
Well,
yeah.
My impression was that it was a typical scenario where he's like, you know I don't want to be with her ultimately.
Yeah.
And staying with her is just interfering with me trying to find my soulmate.
Yeah.
But as she would say, he would say that she was his kryptonite, whether that's lust or that love bombing, probably both, honestly, that he just couldn't deny.
Yeah.
He knew that she wasn't a good partner because of how jealous and controlling she was, and possibly because she wasn't a pure, chaste, good Mormon. I mean, that's the allegation, but it's hard to know what's going through his mind.
But he knew that other part, which is that if he wanted to, he had access to a very sexually giving and emotionally giving person who would shower him with affection and love and sex.
Right.
So that was enticing.
Yeah. And, you know, it is a question that I've wondered about. Of course, we'll never know. If she didn't have the controlling, stalking, jealous behavior where she would break into his email and stuff. Like, this is when they were having a good relationship. It got worse afterwards. Because the allegation or the suspicion is that, and the way they frame it in the documentaries often, is that he needed to have the Madonna, not the whore.
Yeah.
And he needed a pure, chaste virgin, essentially, is what they're implying in these documentaries. But I think that is assuming things. I mean, certainly that could be true, and certainly there are a lot of Mormon men that will be this way, overtly. But it's also possible that he actually, because he did convert her, and she did convert, and she did become a good Mormon, aside from the sexuality thing. You know, there are plenty of Mormon couples that began their long-time love relationship and marriage with premarital sex. You know, it's not uncommon. And so I just wonder if she didn't have that controlling part of it, but I don't know. It's hard to say.
I mean, look, you know, my first girlfriend in college was the person, it was ironically an ex-Mormon, was the person that I had sex with, and when I didn't intend to, because I was intending to wait till I was married because I was Catholic at the time, all these things. And then after I started dating this person, and it was great, and we actually got along great. We were good friends, not just, you know, it wasn't just about the sex and stuff. But I started feeling bad. I started feeling guilty, dirty, like I'd violated my vows, like all these kinds of things. And it was also not an exclusive relationship. We were allowed to see other people. And I started feeling like this wasn't for me, you know, and I broke it off because I had those feelings. But it wasn't because the person was doing anything bad, you know, and they were completely honest and open with everything. Like, and we remained friends. Like, I never have a bad thing to say about this person.
How does this relate to Travis?
Because I can relate to that feeling of you have a relationship and it could work, but you're feeling like you've sinned and you're guilty and you... And it's not right.
That's why you broke it up with her?
Yeah.
That's why you broke up with her?
That's why I broke up.
Because you were...
I felt like it was. I was in sin. I had violated my vows.
So if it was years later when you don't have that mindset, you would have continued with it?
I don't know if we would have worked out, but I would have certainly not broken up. Because it was we had a good relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Now, in his case, of course, it sounds like it wasn't that great of a relationship. But right. I think maybe what you're getting at is there might have been a needle to thread for these two
right.
that could have ended up okay.
Yeah, I think everyone assumes, and the way they work it out in the documentaries, was that it was doomed because of his fundamentalist Christian ideals. And that absolutely could be. I mean, certainly, as you pointed out, even smart Umberto went through that. You know, anyone can have that point of view, and they're free to have that point of view. But I think there's
given how much they were love bombing each other in the beginning, I think there's a possibility. So one, if she wasn't so controlling and wasn't as clingy, I think there's a possibility that even given her lack of purity, that there's a chance that he might have seen it through. All right, well, let's end chapter two there. And when we return, let's continue with my notes. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
And everyone, patrons, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.